Hi, I'm Oliver Wang.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock. You know, a banger, arson, all types of combustible material. Mm. Today, we'll be deep diving together into Michael Jackson's thrilling 1979 album, Off the Wall.
I feel like I want to rock.
Michael cut an album without his brothers in August. It's called Off the Wall, and it's headed for triple platinum, meaning 3 million sold. This song, Rock With You, is from the album.
I wanna rock with you all night. Dance you in the day.
You hear it everywhere. It seems to have become the skater's anthem in Southern California.
When I was 21, it was a very good year. So sang Frank Sinatra on his 1965 album, September of My Years. As 21st years go, Michael Jackson's in 1979 was killing, because when he was 21, he dropped the multi-platinum, critically acclaimed, Grammy Hall of Fame star-making album, Off the Wall, for Epic Records. If his collaboration with Quincy Jones on The Wiz left fans wondering what else was possible for the duo, they got their answer on Friday, August the 10th, 1979, when the dude and the not-yet-crowned king of pop blessed us with 10 tracks of bliss, including bangers like Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, I Can't Help It, which is my jam, and Rock With You. He didn't just release a summer jam, he was a summer jam. Listening to the album again recently, I thought what I would have given to be a fly on the wall during the recording of Off the Wall. This album to me in three words, a heat rock.
So tonight, gotta leave the 9 to 5 upon the shelf and just enjoy yourself. Groove, let the madness and the music get to you like it's so bad at all. You live it off the wall.
To talk about Off the Wall, we have in studio with us musician, educator, and bandleader Martin Perna. You may know him best as the founder of Antibalas, which I believe is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. I first heard Martin back in the 1990s, though, on saxophone when he was a member of New York's Soul Providers, a band that played with a corrections officer and part-time wedding singer named Sharon Jones. Rest in peace to Sharon. Mm. And since that time, Martin's played with everyone from Mark Ronson to TV on the Radio to Elvis Costello to Scarlett Johansson. Okay. Martin, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
One of my favorite things about when we ask guests to throw album choices at us is that is when it doesn't line up necessarily with expectations. So if you had said, for example, oh, I want to talk about like a Fela Kuti record or something by Pharoah Sanders, I would have been like, that's awesome. And that totally makes sense. But then you expressed interest in Michael Jackson's Off the Wall. And I know both me and Morgan were instantly like, yes, let us definitely do that. And, you know, I don't want to say it's surprising only because it's only one of the most important pop albums of the last, 50 years. But why Michael Jackson and why this album?
Well, there's a few reasons. The first more personal reason is that it's the first record that I remember the cover of. I grew up around...
Interesting.
Both of my mom and dad had record collections. Mm-hmm. And my Uncle Frank, my godfather, was visiting from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia where I grew up. And I just remember he had just bought it. It was on the floor... by the little shelf on, I can even say it was on the north side of the house. I have a weird sense of direction, like it was facing south. And then he put it on and I was like, wow, it blew my mind. And then I would hear those songs, particularly the singles, over the next couple of months on the radio. One of the things is that it's such a holistically, as someone who went on to make music, I didn't grow up making records or playing concerts when I was a kid, just appreciating the craft of it as well, because it really stands at the pinnacle of a bunch of different forces, like recording technology, mm-hmm. the people who were on the scene playing, mm-hmm. The different sort of evolutions of soul music, pop music, the ways that, you know, there's a Carol Bayer Sager song, like mm-hmm. all these songwriters, just the best songwriters and the best producers and the funkiest musicians and the best singer and performer. So it was really the pinnacle of so many things. I'm like, man, you know, we take that for granted because right. we're, you know, we were alive when it came out, maybe little, but it's important to, as we build this canon of a good American stuff, that this remains at the center of that.
Yeah. It's funny because I also remember distinctly the album cover of Off the Wall, and I'm almost certain this was probably my introduction to Michael Jackson in any form that I still can remember now. And I remember what the cover looked like. I was age 7, so I was probably a couple years older than you, but not by much. I remember the cover. I remember Off the Wall, the song itself, in terms of what it sounded like and the bass lines from it. And certainly, you know, we once we age into the Thriller era, Michael Jackson goes, you know, supernova on all of us. But I'm wondering, you probably were barely a toddler, or maybe just a little bit out of that at that mm-hmm. point. Were you actively listening to a lot of Michael Jackson at that age?
I was 4. I remember watching the Jackson 5 cartoon.
Oh.
Hey, man, this is cool, huh? Would you believe it all started because of a snake? You see, I'm Michael Jackson. And a couple of years ago, me and my big brothers, Marlon, Jermaine, Tito, and Jackie, lived kind of square and quiet back home in Gary, Indiana. And one day, Miss Diana...
But this was something else, like the little bit of solo work that he did, you know, in between and outside of the Jackson 5. I was definitely not walking, you know, wobbling to the record store, but I was 4 when Off the Wall came out. And I really, you know, there's different other, we could go on for hours, like just flipping through, they were on the floor, you know, they weren't high up on shelves. So that was like something as a toddler, I could just kind of yeah. look at like this whole library of stuff and not be able to pull something out and play it, but just kind of like, yeah, I want to hear this, you know, where's the DJ?
Yeah, Morgan, same question for you. Did you grow up listening to either the J5 era or solo era Michael Jackson?
Well, brethren, I don't want to say how old I was when this album came out. I'll just say that I was a youth. came up on this album because of a record store in Inglewood. And at the time, my mother and brother and I were living in Inglewood. There was a really cool record store down the street. And I, too, saw the album cover. I was familiar with the Jackson 5 because of the cartoon mm-hmm. and just because of songs on the radio. But this, to me, is a distinct cover because it was Michael Jackson by himself. Mm. Smooth, the wall in the backdrop. He's got the ill tuxedo on, the ill socks. he looked hella happy. I couldn't put the, you know, I was too young to think, has he gone solo? I didn't even have those conversations yet. I just thought, wow, this is Michael Jackson by himself. And I was a fan of The Wiz, so I was a fan of Jackson.
You can't win.
So that was You Can't Win, which was one of the standout tracks from The Wiz, Michael Jackson as the Scarecrow. Speaking of Quincy Jones said in an interview a few years back that he and Michael did almost a dozen takes
wow.
of She's Out of My Life, and actually that Michael Jackson cried at the end of every one of them.
I kept my love for her locked deep inside. Like a knife, she's out of my life.
Do you see this album as giving us an intimate look at Michael Jackson?
He's a quintessential performer, and to be able to get to that place in his heart where he can authentically sing the tune. I feel like he did that on every tune, and going back and knowing a little bit more about the backstory, it doesn't surprise me because there's these two perfectionists in the room with a tremendous amount of respect for each other, and also just, you know, everyone else around them is they were the top people, so they
sure.
wanted to give it the best. Wow, but 12, that's a lot of tissues.
12
yeah.
takes, and actually yeah. the song was written originally for Frank Sinatra and wasn't recorded, so it would have been interesting to hear
wow.
a completely different take if it had been Frank Sinatra,
indeed.
Really croony.
I think in hindsight, it's easy to imagine that Michael Jackson had always been a superstar. I mean, obviously, when he coming out on the scene as part of the Jackson 5, as the lead singer of Jackson 5, you know, singing ABC, we were introduced to Michael Jackson as a child already at peak stardom level. There's at least two ways I think we can think about Off the Wall. I think the actual kind of, you know, historical perspective is that it's the album that really resurrected Michael, because by this point in the mid-late 70s, Jackson 5 had left Motown. They had to rename themselves the Jacksons. It had been 4 years between solo projects for Michael. So even though he had made the turn from child star into sort of early adulthood and was showing that he could at least hold together solo albums, the kind of superstar that we imagine of him now, that was not where he was in that era. Off the Wall really is what pushed him in that direction. I mean, it was obviously a massive album in its own right, and of course set the stage for Thriller a few years later. But I think in memory, we always just assume that Michael was always just larger than life, and that right. Off the Wall was just one hugely important stepping stone. But it creates this kind of complete narrative of Michael always being successful, never having to necessarily struggle in the way. And I'm wondering, for each of you, specifically with Off the Wall, where do you fit this album into your larger sense of Michael Jackson's artistry? Why don't we start with you, Martine?
Well, it was the stage, like you said, where he was going from adolescence to manhood and realized that the future, he had to really get on his grind.
Yeah.
And develop a really singular voice, and not just a single, but a whole album. And at the same time, the opportunity that he had with Quincy Jones and with all of these studio musicians, arrangers, you know, and some of the best songs that he could, songwriters, including stuff that he wrote, this was the opportunity. And like, it sounds cliche, but like the star he is, he saw that door and walked through it and made it happen. You know, he caught the pass, and then it was a clutch moment, you know, because there's plenty of other artists who were in a similar period that experienced
that.
And then their first solo album was not strong, or it seemed to really fall off. And it was like, oh, where did that magic go that they had when they were 17? At 21, they're not really that interesting anymore.
Yeah.
Magic is a good word, because in November of 79, Michael Jackson wrote on one of the back of the tour programs that he wanted this time, this tour, this album to be magic. Mm. He wanted to be magic. The way I rate Off the Wall in terms of his artistry is, to me, this was personal Michael. This was Michael before he was crowned king. And so to me, I feel a lot closer to him than I did around Thriller or Bad. This was Michael Light. You know, someone was saying to us, you know, you sound a lot different on the air when you're smiling. Off the Wall feels like 10 tracks of Michael Jackson smiling. Mm-hmm. With no records to chase, no tons of Grammys, and then the expectation, the requisite expectations. So for me, if he had stopped recording here, that would already have been enough for me.
Right.
Not just because it's genius, and to your point, it certainly is a first Ballad Hall of Fame canon album. But to me, this is Happy Michael. Mm-hmm. It's Happy Michael and Quincy before the shadow of Bad and the expectation after Thriller. You feel me?
Yeah. I had never thought about it like that, as far as, wow, I wish Michael were able to live in that Off the Wall space for like at least 4 more years and enjoy it. Because when I think about the whole trajectory of his life, it was like, you know, high points and very low points, and just tragedy. And the bigger he got, the more problems, you know, encountered, and just people and things. And like you say, this was a happy Michael. And I think all of us who are such fans of his music, you know, if you reflect on it like that, it's like, oh yeah, wow, he really should have been able to enjoy that period more.
I love what you have to say about this idea of an album where you can hear Michael smiling on all these 10 tracks. And not only smiling, and the album cover, to bring it back to that, it's also him dancing, right? And it's about the dancing machine, Michael. And I think it's worth bringing into sort of how this album fits into just the larger trajectory of American pop music in the era, and especially around at the point in which disco is in transition.
Especially
That was Get on the Floor, very sexy disco, Michael Jackson. And although this album started production in the summer of 78, it was released almost a month after the infamous day that disco died, July the 12th, 79. Given the backlash against disco, the anti-disco sentiment and movement, why do you think that this album with this disco funk tones, why did this flourish? Why did this resonate with fans?
That was not so much against disco, but against black music entering the mainstream. Mm. And this was, you know, the one of the pinnacles or crowning jewels of black music. And I think regardless of whether it's disco or funk or soul, people loved it. They couldn't, nothing stuck to it. No label stuck to it,
you know,
because the production was that tight. And then if you look at all the people who were involved credits wise, it was like, this was a very multicultural affair between the songwriters, the musicians and all that. But I think it was just, even people who didn't like, there's something that you could find. Everybody's got a song in there. It's impossible to hate this record, or at least to find something that doesn't, you know, get you tapping your feet or smiling or feeling that energy.
Right. I just wondered if Quincy Jones ever thought, I don't know if we should go this route because of the feeling that's going on around up-tempo black music at the moment.
Real quick, and for listeners who are not familiar with the incident that we're talking about that happened in July of 79, I think this was at Wrigley Field.
Sure was.
And it was sort of a disco sucks night or something along those lines. And they got all of these disco records and put it in the middle of the baseball field and then steamrolled it or did something. I mean, basically a wanton act of disco destruction. And it was, as both you have been talking about, this is part of a larger backlash against disco, not the least of which is because I think disco represents not just on a racial level, but also in terms of the sexuality. It represents sort of a threat to kind of a, I don't know, not to get too academic about this, but a very kind of hegemonic, heteronormative masculinity, and that disco engendered part of this backlash, in addition to just being, it was the big successful thing, and people always like railing against that. So this is, what, 2 years after Saturday Night Fever?
Sure.
Disco fever has already swept the nation. So I think there's a lot of layers to that backlash. But Morgan, as you're bringing up, it does seem an interesting point where, is Quincy thinking, maybe we should take this in a different direction?
And that the Usher said that people weren't just bringing disco records. He saw a guy with a Marvin Gaye record, you know, so it wasn't just like Casey and the Sunshine Band or Funky Town or like, Georgia Moroder or some of the things, you know,
just
it was like,
music.
And that was like, oh, wow, this is a bigger statement than just, okay, this sort of, it wasn't the death of a cliche. It was was a part of a culture war.
Mm-hmm. Which lets me know, you know, how gangster Quincy Jones was. Not only did he decide to do this record, but, you know, one of the first videos, you got Michael Jackson, you got disco lights around him, he's got on a glossy suit, sliding up, dancing from side to side. So shout out to Quincy for being like, you know what, there may be backlash, but we're going with it.
That's what makes Quincy Quincy.
For sure. You know, Martine, I was really surprised to find out that the three tracks that Michael Jackson wrote from the album were Working Day and Night, Get on the Floor, and Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. That surprised me, maybe my own, I'm projecting here, but I would have thought Michael Jackson wrote the slow jams. Does it surprise you that the three jams he wrote were the up-tempo ones?
No, part of it is that I got a couple years ago, we were on tour, and somebody had the reissue where they had like the demo tracks where you could hear all the percussion parts and like him playing these clave patterns on a bottle and stuff. And I was like, whoa, that, you know, I wish I got to hear more of the sort of what Michael's original raw ideas, because I was like, this is great. And then when you hear just the little bits of syncopation, you can hear that sensibility, which is very, it's, you know, ties into Afro-Cuban music, into West African music, these different Makossa patterns, and just the way that, you know, so much of this album as a music nerd is written in clave, like this sort of rhythmic syntax that governs every kind of music from West Africa, from Brazil, from the Caribbean. So that's one of the, and getting to sort of hear that little, those snippets of the making of, like, oh, he's, you know, he's versed in this. He's really versed in this. And when he gets to the opportunity to write and put forth these songs, that comes out in the compositions.
We're gonna be starting now, baby. Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop till you get enough.
He played percussion on a lot of this album, and when he wasn't playing, it was Paulinho da Costa did the rest. So you hear, I heard a lot of Brazilian, you know, undertones in there, and I was like, okay. Again, in researching for today, there was a lot I learned about the production of Off the Wall. But to your point, a lot of West African, a lot of Brazilian music. It just surprised me. I thought he was going to be like, everything was going to be like, you know, She's Out of My Life. I thought everything was going to sound like that.
She's out of my life. She's out of my life. And I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I don't know whether.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Martine Perna about Michael Jackson's Off the Wall after a brief word from some of our other fine Maximum Fun podcasts. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome, everyone, to the live wrestling spectacular in Los Angeles.
So far, the world's most boring wrestling podcast has been destroying the competition.
Isn't there anyone who can save us from this travesty?
Wait, could it be?
It's Tights and Fights, the perfect wrestling podcast.
Tights and Fights is here to save us from the monotony of boring wrestling podcasts with hilarious conversations.
Woke trips through the history of wrestling.
And joke about the finer points of people wearing spandex.
What a match!
And the Tights and Fights podcast will be back every week.
Thursdays on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts. Please, these hosts have families.
Tights and Fights podcast. Tights and Fights.
Hey everyone, Freddie Wong,
Matt Arnold,
and Will Campos.
Here to tell you about Story Break, a writer's room podcast where every week we, the Hollywood geniuses behind Video Game High School, have 1 hour to turn a humble idea into an awesome movie.
Thrill as we weave the tragic tale of Jar Jar, a Star Wars story.
We're going to double down on everything that made the prequels great. Jar Jar, Trade Federation, politics.
Gasp as we assemble a pantheon of heroes for the Kellogg Cinematic Universe.
We could get rid of Snap, Crackle, Pop. I won't even miss them.
You're crazy.
They die in the second act.
Oh, come on.
And join us as we make fun of Matt as he struggles to name a single Beyonce song.
Well, yeah, put a finger on it. Sure, she wants to be Beyonce.
Put a finger on it. Beyonce's famous song.
Will we break the story?
Or will the story break us?
Find out by joining us in the writer's room every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back on Heat Rocks talking about Michael Jackson's Off the Wall with Martine Perna of Antibalas. We should really take some more time here to dig deep into the production of the album. I know we've already covered this, but I mean, this is such an important part of the effect, or the affect, if you will, of Off the Wall. You know, 20, actually not even 20, what, 30, almost 40 years later, this album still sounds incredible. All the layers that you hear. And for me, the first few bars of I Can't Help It are damn near magical to listen to. Martine, I'm wondering, especially as a musician, as a songwriter, as a producer yourself, what do you hear when you go back and listen to this album?
It's so lush. The arrangements are really well thought out. I was walking today, and I had to run an errand, and I'm in L.A., so it felt weird to walk. But I was listening to these guitar parts, and there was so much craft, but also so much restraint, like these little kind of earworm lines that fit together as part of this tapestry. They could be playing them through the whole bar, but they don't. They just play them at like right where they need to, you know, and that everybody collectively, the players had the ears to not overplay and the mixers had the ears to sort of, you know, just give everything just the, it's so balanced, you know, when it needs to be big, it's big. And when it needs to sort of be more intimate or building, that happens. So again, in, you know, having been in the process of making records, it's like, this is something we strive for, even though we make music that sounds different. all of those things, that balance, you know, between the levels and how they're recording. And again, they were working with the best musicians, the best mics. I think they had like 48. They had a lot more tracks than most albums do, to be able to bring in strings and horns. And so technologically, too, as far as analog recording, this was sort of at, it didn't get any bigger than this as far as the amount of track, maybe Thriller, you know, and then it started to dial down through the 90s as digital came along. But it was that, you know, that part of that moment, too, where everything was just at the peak.
And then what a gift to be singing a song written by Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
I wanted you to talk a little bit more about, I love what you said about restraint. So can you talk a little bit more about what you heard in the song in terms of the arrangement of the song?
Well, I like the keyboards a lot, and that's Greg Phillinganes and George Duke on most of those. And Greg Phillinganes is one of my favorite keyboard players of all time, and it's like all this stuff that I'm just, I got to play with him at Carnegie Hall 2 years ago. He was that musical director for the tribute to Bill Withers, the 40th anniversary of the Carnegie concert, and we were the horn section. So I got to let me just go back and see everything that he did. And it was like Chaka Khan and Toto and all these like jams. And I was like, oh, of course he's on like every track. So that in particular, the keyboards, the electric piano, that's
so
laced
key.
Throughout.
No, no pun intended, but so key, right?
And I like that. I like what you did right there, Holmes.
Between the beds, you know, these big lush beds and kind of rises and flourishes, and then just these sort of funky riffs. And to find one person who has that whole voice that can kind of play throughout the record and every, you know, I can't imagine this record particularly without him.
I mean, everyone talks about Michael Jackson's falsetto. What I like about I Can't Help It is even the way he uses his falsetto is restrained. It's in later albums where we hear him sort of straining himself. Man in the Mirror, where he builds to this crescendo and it's almost straining his voice. Here he rides.
The other thing about I Can't Help It that always kills me in a good way when I'm going through this album, especially in sequenced order, is that She's Out of My Life, which we'll talk about later, but as a ballad is so quiet. I can't think of a quieter ballad that Jackson's ever done. And in some ways, it almost feels like the end of an album because it just winds everything down. And then coming out of that song, even though I've listened to this album so many times, the beginning of I Can't Help It is always this incredible surprise because you're not expecting it. You're not anticipating it. And it's like this gift that the song and the album gives you, especially in sequence.
Yes, sir.
And you know, we've talked about this on the show before. I'm a big fan of thinking about sequencing, and I feel like for whatever reason, like not enough albums are really well sequenced, that they just feel a little bit jumbled. And this album, everything I feel like is where it really needs to absolutely be.
Yeah.
So for me, if I had to pick a fire track, I would be stuck somewhere between I Can't Help It and Rock With You. Somehow we've managed to go this whole episode without talking about Rock With You. We'll have to maybe bring that back later. But Martine, what is your fire track off this album?
What's my Don't Stop is my fire track. And the strings, you know, I'm just imagining like being in, looking at that whole string section, playing those 16 notes that are so hip, and then being like, what is it? Wow, this is amazing, because they're probably not coming from something that sounded like this. Like just the excitement of playing on it, the bounce, the fact that I've been 40 different countries and probably heard this song in 40 different countries and seen 40 different, you know, types of people dancing to it, weddings, white weddings, black weddings, you know, school, you know, everywhere. It's like, this is something that he sang happy. Yeah. There's that, again, it's like the high pitched where the shakers in the beginning and then ding, dook, ding, ding, dook, that goes throughout. There's again, you can hear that in the demos, and it's hard to imagine hearing this without that. You know, it's an organic thing. Like, it sounds like something that's not, you know, a $4,000 guitar that's in there that needs to be in there. It's not, it's an ancient sound in a very modern sounding record.
I have a lot of favorite parts to Don't Stop, Get Enough, you know, starting with the entire song. But the end of it, the last 40 seconds, and every time I listen to this, I'm still not sure what all is happening in the studio. Let's just take a quick listen to the last minute of the song. And maybe the two of you can help me. What are we listening to? Are there two different guitars? Like, what is that little plinky sound? Like, what's happening here?
I wish I could sit down in the room with Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones and ask them, were they listening to Fela? You know, what directly of West African music were they listening to? Because this is, you know, when they talk about James Brown and Fela, they always say that Fela copied from James Brown, but and forgetting that Fela was in Hollywood for 6 months in 1969, playing six nights a week. And so, one specifically the and after they were here, you heard the two interlocking guitar parts, what we call an Afrobeat, the tenor guitar that plays the single note patterns, and then the rhythm guitar that plays the sort of syncopated chords, and they're just these, you know, two or four bar patterns that don't change and they lock into each other. And so whether, you know, Michael suggested that or whether the arrangers did, but There was a point where these musicians were like, there was a lot of stuff coming out from West Africa, particularly Fela, but all this great high life stuff.
Yeah.
And people were catching on to that. You know, Roy Ayers had just made a record with Fela the year before in like 78.
Open that book and go dictionary. Open and let you see. I said, open that book and go dictionary. Open and let you see. Upside down and made a proper. Open and let you see. Them recognize the word for sure, yes. Open and let you see.
I wonder, you know, where, because that was something, those interlocking guitars that weren't in American music in the same way that much prior to the mid-70s.
And I'm sort of expecting, because of the break in that song, I'm waiting for Earth, Wind, and Fire to show up. Mm-hmm. It's very Serpentine Fire, Brazilian rhyme. That sort of reminds me of the end, which is also West African and Brazilian music. And
I never thought about the Afrobeat comparison in terms of what those two different guitars are doing at the end of it. But it's to me really unexpected because the song has it just jumps off the moment you hear Michael Jackson do that. You know the. And just launches. Yeah. But the end is not so much quiet per se, but it really strips layer by layer until that's all you're left with. And then the song fades. And it's just an interesting choice from an arrangement point of view to have the song shift into that direction, but never thought about it. But yeah, that makes total sense now that you mention it.
One of the things I also like about that is the drums are stripped away. And it's just percussion and the synths and the guitars. But you can hear the drums. It's almost like the rhythmic scaffolding is pulled away and your mind is doing all that work because those parts are just so rhythmic themselves. It's not just a little riff. It's like a whole bed of that. And you realize like, wow, this is, you know, the drums provided some rhythm, but there was so much more in here. And it's rare that on a big pop record that they will kind of pull away these different veils and let you see or hear, experience what's going on in the music besides, you know, without the drums.
I thought you were going to pick Rock With You. I don't want to project, okay, my own intentions, but I thought you were going to pick Rock With You.
You gotta feel that heat, and we can ride the boogie, share that beat of love. I'll rock with you all night, dance you into the sunlight. I'll rock with you all night, gonna rock the night.
Rock With You is my fire track, I guess, and I guess I want it to be everybody's, but it's the one that when I hear it, and I heard it several months after Michael Jackson passed, and it's the one for me that makes the loss so hard. It's the one that makes it so profound when I hear that. So I thought you were gonna pick a Rock With You. No judgment.
I only get one fire track. It's like there's a genie in a bottle. You get one wish. You don't get three wishes.
Sure.
You know.
My bad, Martina.
You can give me another Heat Rock wish, and then I'll wish for a Rock With You. I'll be happy.
Okay, listen. Fair enough. Fair enough.
So we have some competition for the fire track. Martine, what's your sleeper jam off this album?
My sleeper track would be Burn This Disco Out. You know, living in New York since, you know, the early 90s, and DJs would play a lot of Michael's tracks. That one I heard a lot less, but then going back and listening to it, this is not just three or four cuts off this album, but this is a whole thing. And here's this gem, and it was fun to go back to a record that I thought I really knew and didn't in digging this. Yeah, as a horn player too, like this one, I mean, there's great horns throughout, but this one, those are the first things that you hear, the horns up front. And as a horn player, I like when there's records that give us, as a section, the opportunity to shine, and just, you know, that's the first thing that you hear. So that was also the kind of thing, like when I heard it the first several times, I wasn't a horn player, so I didn't necessarily, it was just one other sound. And now it's like, I have this emotional relationship to someone writing some great horn work and putting it right out front, and then the groove dropping.
Rod Temperton, Heat Wave. And it's worth noting that he also produced Rock With You, that didn't get quite the love that I wanted it to get in this conversation. So I'm going to return to that, but also a gem. And shout out to Rod Temperton, the late, great Rod Temperton.
Martine, I think you were hinting at this, or maybe just blatantly stating this. The big hits off this album are so iconic, right? I mean, we've talked about some of them. We're going to continue to talk about some of the other ones. It's easy to forget, even though it's such a short album, only 10 tracks, you can name easily 3-4 on your deathbed. Like, you're never going to forget Don't Stop. You're not going to ever forget Rock With You. And then I always forget, oh yeah, Burn This Disco Out was on here. And I think maybe part of it is I don't necessarily love this song in the same way I love everything else. This is not to me an album that I would sit down with and go end to end and enjoy everything at a relatively equal level. It's not Illmatic by my standards. But it's funny to think that, yeah, there are actually other gems on this that are not the obvious gems that we all think about all the time. And, right. and I think Burn This Disco Out is a great example of that, that this is an incredibly well-made song just compared to sort of the intensity, white-hot lava that is elsewhere on this album. Some things are just not going to rise to that same level.
Right. Like It's the Falling in Love, which is another little sleeper gem.
It's only going to happen again.
And Girlfriend.
Girlfriend, I'm gonna show you boyfriend. Yeah, show him the letters I've been saving. Yeah, show him how you feel inside.
Martine, this might be a challenging question to ask, because I think anytime an artist takes on another artist's music, there are a lot of complicated decisions and feelings that go into that. If you were forced to cover a song off this album, which track would you cover?
The track that I would cover is Working Day and Night. Again, the percussion and the sort of the percussive sensibilities of it are so funky that's what we lead with in our group, between that and horns, and so many different ways that you could play with that, and that our lead singer could sort of work with that, or we could take that into a conga pattern or arrange some horns, like some interlocking horn part.
The this album, Off the Wall, if you had to describe it in three words, what would those three words be?
Happy, funky, virtuosic.
Wow, that may be the fastest three words people came up
right.
with. We're here struggling, like picking over every word. Now that was
That's
great.
That's dope. For
very,
sure.
Very good. That'll do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Martin Perna. What's the most recent project that you put out?
Well, we just finished a tour, an album tour, Antibalas' sixth record in 20 years.
Nice. Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Amazing accomplishment.
Thank you. It's called Where the Gods Are in Peace. We went all throughout the U.S. and Japan, Spain, have a bunch more tour dates, and writing the next record. Me and the horn section are doing a version of Remain in Light with Angelique Kidjo. We did it at Carnegie Hall, and we're doing it around the world. And my little obscure side project, Occulting Soul Sounds, we're writing album number 5 right now in Texas. So yeah, and I'll be teaching. I'll be teaching a course on diasporic music and social movements in the 20th century. Spring semester at Penn State University. So yeah, I'm busy.
Shout out.
I want to telecommute out and catch that.
For sure.
That sounds dope. And where can people find you?
They can find me at my website, martinperna.com or antibalas.com.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes. Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Thanks to him for that. Heat Rocks is produced by myself, Morgan Rhodes, Shannon Deloria, and Kara Hart. And today's show was engineered and edited by Kara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Max Fun family, taping every week live in their off-the-wall studios in the neighborhood of Westlake in Los Angeles. We want to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers. This week it was Disco Sam. Thank you so much for that. If you have not had a chance yet, please consider leaving us a review. It is a great way in which we can build our audience.
We also wanted to thank all of our social media fans out there, including Enrico Benjamin, Cycle 60, Martin B3000, Gossip Culture, and Neighborhamson. Thank you so much for your tweezies and your retweezies. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. And before we get out of here, here is a teaser clip from our back-to-back Michael Jackson episodes. This is Justin Simeon from Dear White People talking about Michael Jackson's His Story.
So, you know, Michael for me was like my first hero. I remember being in kindergarten and it was like, y'all, this is a real story, okay? So it was like after nap time, they would show us one of like 2 or 3 movies, and it was like the Care Bear movie, it was some other crap, and it was Moonwalker. And I, let me tell you something, I like campaigned for Moonwalker pre-lunchtime, okay? We would like get the hot dog day, have our lunch or whatever, and I'd be like, okay, so, you know, after naps, so how about that Moonwalker though? You know, like I was like obsessed. All right, so this is the first time I, as a little black boy, saw a black man, you know, turning into robots and stuff, and like shooting magic, and like a shooting star would fly by, and he could like transform into things. Like he was magic to me. Like he actually was magic.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.